What's it like to be a black female reporter and host on a public radio station in Texas? Turns out, kinda lonely. Actually make that very lonely, because Dalia Jones is the only person who fits all those criteria. Jones is a reporter, podcaster, and local All Things Considered host at KUT-FM in Austin, and she's inadvertently a role model for girls of color who might want to pursue a career in public media, but don't see or hear anyone who looks anything like them. On this episode of Convo, Jones and I have an enlightening and sometimes beautifully uncomfortable conversation about what a chore it can be to be a rural-raised African-American woman in an overwhelmingly white world. I don't want to make this, you know, about, say, white privilege or not, but I've thought about white privilege a lot, especially in the past 8 or 9 months with white privilege or male privilege, especially since the Me Too movement started in earnest, you know, last year. Mm-hmm. And I've thought, you know, there is the thing about me being a straight white guy is in America is I'm, quote, normal. You know, I mean, I'm the guy that everybody is sort of judged against or whatever over the course of most of U.S. history. And from that perch, I didn't necessarily notice that people always looked like me. It was never a question mm-hmm. about, you know, oh, well, I a white guy can be president. Well, they were all white guys until, you know, a decade ago, you know, and or a white guy could run a business or a corporation or something. And I never really stopped to think about it from position of, say, someone like yourself. You didn't see anybody who looked like you mm-hmm. growing up. So I'm curious, like, who are your role models for, you know, I mean, how did you, you know, I mean, how lonely is it being who you are?
Yeah. So I guess I can start by giving a little of my background. I grew up in a very rural, small town in East Texas, Lufkin, which is right next to Nacogdoches. And for people who don't know where that is, it's right next to Tyler.
Right.
And for people who don't know where that is, it's 2 hours from Houston.
Yeah. Or right next to Louisiana. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. An hour away from Louisiana. And I think growing up in a space where a lot of the black people there and just a lot of the people of color are really marginalized, right? We're really surrounded by a lot of white people all the time. So I kind of already knew how to navigate that space on my own. But I think that I did not realize how white public media was until maybe my senior year of college, whenever I had decided that I wanted to pursue this part of media. Yeah, like you said earlier, it's been very isolating and very lonely, especially being a rookie, right? I only graduated college a year and a half ago. And so it's kind of being thrown into hell's hot fire by myself
right.
and having to learn on my own. But then outside of Texas, I do have mentors who I kind of look up to and who, you know, kind of guide me along the way. And also, I think that this is not only a learning experience for me, but for a lot of the white people who are, you know, in public media, especially here in Texas. Here at KUT, I'm the first black woman to be hired in 15 years. And I think that this is a learning experience for both me and the station and the editors as well, like Ben and Matt, right? I don't think that they really necessarily had the conversation about diversity until like a few years ago. So I think this is kind of a learning experience for ourselves. I wouldn't say that I have a straightforward answer of how I navigate it, but I think just as a person of color, I'm just used to having to. So yeah, I don't know if that was a good enough answer.
Well, yeah. Oh, no, please don't worry about the quality of your answers. It's, you know, but no, it's an intriguing thing because, you know, like I said, I think, you know, when, let's put it this way, around a lot of other white people myself, when a topic like, say, white privilege comes up or white position or white power or whatever that, not white power, but you know what I mean? White power, white positions of power in the community.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing is when people mention white privilege, you get a lot of groans from white people who I think what they think is that we're talking about, you know, having this extra special lifestyle just because we're white. And, you know, mm-hmm. That's not necessarily the case. Like when I go to the store, they still charge me for my groceries. You know,
yeah.
I don't get free food because, like, oh, you're white. Here, take some stuff. You know, like, I don't get that, you know, but the privilege as I see it is exactly kind of what you're talking about, is that sense of, you know, I wouldn't have noticed that everybody around me was white because I never had to, you know, or if I were going into public media, I wouldn't have noticed it, you know, because I didn't really need to. Everybody looks like me. And it's such an interesting thing that I've read this, that we're, you know, the makeup of the United States of America, you know, in terms of who's white, who's black, who, you know, number of gun owners, number of military veterans, is not at all reflected in public media, which strives so hard to have that kind of balance, that kind of diversity to it. But I don't necessarily see a lot of diversity, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that white people will have this, right, like this different life. But I think that the consequences of living every day are very different for people of color, right? You know, just based on my skin color, that's life or death. You know, we are in situations where black people are being gunned down, right? On the side of the road, you know, getting stopped by cops. You know, we have people who are being deported back, you know, you know, to their country of origin where they were born just because of the way that they look. But this wouldn't necessarily happen to, like, let's say a white immigrant in this particular area. So I don't know. I think, I don't know. This is actually a conversation I actually had with somebody earlier today who's also kind of from like the Southwest. She's from like Tennessee, right?
Okay.
And we were talking about how a lot of Northerners don't really necessarily understand a lot of the people of color. I don't think that they understand kind of what we go through as Southerners, because a lot of Northerners judge us, you know, they're like, you know, why do you stay in the South? Why do you put up with this? Why do you put up with being called, you know, the N-word in the middle of a Walmart parking lot, right? Which has happened to me before.
Right.
You know, why do you put up with this? And I'm like, when you literally learn how to navigate white spaces, and when your family is here, when everything, you know, is here, your life is here, you have to kind of put up with those microaggressions and those racist, you know, problems that come up. And I think that it makes us a lot more callous to a lot of the situations that do happen here. I know I have a friend from Michigan who said that she had experienced, you know, racist encounters, but she had never experienced it to the degree that Texans do here. And she was like, you know, I have more respect for y'all, and I understand, you know, why you guys complain, you know, so much about this and that. And she said, I thought it was bad down there, you know, up there, but it's just like, you know, it's totally different down here. I don't know. I just wish that a lot of more people would understand that. I don't know. I don't even know if that answered your question as well.
Well, I mean, what is interesting is there is a word which I hesitate to say because I don't want it to sound offensive, but I recently heard it, and it is such a great word in terms of what it conveys, and and it's kind of what you're talking about. So, you know, forgive me if it sounds insensitive, but just in the course of this conversation, it seems like it fits. Are you familiar with the word incognito?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I mean, that's how it is. I think that maybe the word that you're looking for is like code switching, right? We know how to code switch very well here in the South.
Right.
And we know how to play it safely here in the South. You know, my grandpa, I was raised up in Lufkin, where my grandpa grew up, you know, before it was bigger than it is right now. And he would tell me stories, right, of like these encounters with white men, you know, even life or death situations where he was just doing his job, right? He used to be a Coca-Cola delivery man. And one time this guy tried to accuse him of trying to rape his wife because his wife was in the back room of the place he was dropping the Cokes off. Right.
Wow.
So you hear things like that, and your parents kind of teach you how to do this code switching, right? How to play your role just to stay safe, not necessarily to impress anybody, but just to stay alive, especially here in the South, right, where everything, I feel like we all have a role that we are fulfilling here in the South. Everybody knows how to play the game, basically, I think. And it's very unfortunate that I have to say that, but at the same time, I mean, it's a reality. It's changing drastically, but it is a reality for some of the people of color still here, especially black people.
Well, how do you actually do it? I mean, we can, you know, in the academic sense, I understand what you're talking about is sort of just not, you know, standing out in any way, or, you know, not positioning as a threat or anything that could be conveyed as a threat. which in and of itself is just, that's a terrible thing that you have to do that. But
yeah.
But how do you do it? Like, what is, in a tangible way, like if you were going to walk into, into Walmart and everybody in there was white and you were the only black person in there. I mean, how do you,
that happens all the time.
How do you navigate it? I mean, what do you do? So,
I don't.
Like, I'm not trying to get like to the secret sauce. Yeah. I don't want to make it sound like, but I mean, but I'm curious, like what actually does that entail when you say navigating the white space? I mean, what happens?
You just try to play it safe the whole time, right? You try to dress well. You try to appear well. A lot of respectability politics, especially where I'm from, right? When I was growing up, I wasn't allowed to leave the house without a belt or earrings on, right? Because I didn't look presentable. And I think that we're aware that we already look different. I'm a 6-foot black woman, right? So I already stand out from the crowd, even amongst other black people who are shorter than me. And so I'm aware of that, but I'm also aware that I have to be but I've always just been taught to just be very careful and to not step on anybody's toes. Now I'm a lot more unapologetic about that, especially being here in Austin, which is a lot more liberal. And although right. Austin has its own issues with race, I'm able to do that freely. But I also see the difference of when I go back home, right? I get, crazy stares from a lot of older white people, right? They don't hold open the door for me. Whenever they're checking out, they cover the key card swiper or whatever that thing is, whenever they check out. And I'm very aware of it. And when I have the opportunity now, I call it out. But when I was little, you just kind of follow along and do whatever your parents say. I don't think that, like you said, there's a secret sauce, but there is a way to like try to stay under the radar. And I do want to emphasize the word try, right? Because obviously this is
right.
is probably not the best way to go at it. But when you come from a completely red area. You know that you're not going to be able to easily change the minds of the people around you, right? But
right.
you can change the minds of the people, and you can and you can wake up those marginalized communities so that change does happen, right? I was not aware of how I guess just flat out racist and discriminatory East Texas was until I went to Texas State University in San Marcos, right? That's only four hours away. Just traveling 4 hours away kind of woke me up, right? And so it takes people like me going back to these small towns, right? And allowing people or making them be more hypervigilant of a lot of the stuff that's been going on, because you don't know whenever you're doing it every single day.
Right. Well, I keep thinking of something I saw. I think it was Frontline that did an episode of. I'm from New Jersey, and so it caught me that I wanted to see this because they were looking at who will police the police in, I think, Newark or Jersey City. I can't remember. I think it was Newark. And there was this conversation that was recorded around this sort of round table, and it was black community leaders talking about how the police sort of have this different view of, people of color, the brown and black people who were there versus the white people and everything. And one woman said something that it still gets me when I think about it, where she said, if you go on YouTube and you search out, say people freaking out around the cops, white people freaking out around the cops, it's comedy. It's funny, mm-hmm. And you see somebody just teeing off on a state trooper and the trooper just being like, okay, you have a good day now, sir. And he just kind of ignores it. And there's like Benny Hill music playing under it or something, And she's like, and then if you try to search a black person in that same situation, it inevitably is the guy he's pepper sprayed or he's stunned or he's thrown over the hood of the car or something. Like, you don't get the same, ability to sort of just be upset about something.
Yeah.
And that really, it bothers me to think about that. And it bothers me to know that, I never actually thought about it until I purposely sort of looked at it, from sort of this journalistic perspective, I guess you might say, where I sort of looked at things and went, wow, I wonder how other people think. I wonder how they feel. I wonder how they go through life. But that is, I'm not trying to sound like I'm some superhero for doing that, but it's just, it was an impetus that came from myself. Whereas if I didn't do that, I don't know, I would still be probably thinking you know, whatever bullshit that I'd thought, you know, when I was 14 or 15, growing up in New Jersey, where things were fairly, you know, segregated and racist by their own volition. Like, nobody came and said, only, you know, white people can only live over here. And, you know, there's no signs or anything, but, you know, you knew not to cross the street.
I think that also kind of speaks to, right, the education of white privilege to white people too, and kind of like having white people go out and learn about these issues on their own. I think that intention and execution are two different things, right? And I think that we have a lot of well-intentioned white people who do want to learn, but I think that sometimes they go about it the wrong way. You know, like, pick up a book, you know, Google it. A lot of white people like to just come to black people personally. And it's like, for me, I just personally have to be in the mood to talk to you about it.
Right.
I mean, just like navigating this world as a black woman in the South is tiring on its own, right? It's exhausting. And to have to talk about that and to have to defend that, it's just like so exhausting and very redundant and very sometimes unproductive if I'm not fully there in the conversation myself, especially if white people are not willing to validate my experiences.
Right.
So, Yeah. I think that speaks to, especially, you know, when it comes to just education, I just tell people to read. All the time, I refer people to books. I refer to people to websites. I'm like, you can do this, you can do that. Because I think that one of the worst things that a lot of white people who are trying to be allies to people of color and to queer folks as well, is to argue back, right? You know, I'm telling you about my experience. I'm telling you, you know, how I'm living every day. I'm telling you that, you know, my high school got sued for having an African-American female literature class, right? I'm telling you that, you know, whenever I was little and I was driving through a town, me and my little cousins thought we saw ghosts, but it was a KKK rally, and my aunt made me put my head down in the back seat. I'm telling you all of these experiences, and to have those not validated is very, like I said, exhausting and very, very mentally tolling as well. And I think that a lot of white people need to be very conscious of that, right? We have a lot of mental health and a lot of depression and a lot of isolation of people of color and queer folks as well, because we are going through these experiences. So just talking about these experiences in itself can be very triggering.
And I can tell you that I do try to be mindful of that, because I know that the first, coming from the white side, I think the first thing that a lot of us want to do is to, who are trying to be sympathetic or trying to say, all right, look, we understand there's something bigger here than we really understand. Mm-hmm. There's that tendency to want to go and talk to somebody face to face. But I do try to be mindful, because I have had this conversation with black people before. And once in a while I get, you know what, I've said this, you know, and everybody can't keep coming to me to explain this. You know, I can't be your black encyclopedia.
I think that's the deal here, right? In public media. And that was one of the things that kind of had, so I always say, like, I don't know if you know who Solange is, but Beyonce's sister, of course, you know, she made A Seat at the Table, which is just about black empowerment. And one of the songs in there, one of my favorites, is Mad. And in the song, she says, you have a right to be mad, right? And so I remember when, at one point, when I was coming into work, I was so upset every day I came into work. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know why I felt like I always I knew why I had to have my guard up, right? But I just didn't know why it was more exhausting than all the other times I've had my guard up. And I had to realize that I was giving my energy to being this encyclopedia, right? I was explaining this over and over again, and I didn't realize that it was exhausting me at the same time.
Hmm. It's interesting that you bring up the point about isolation and sort of mental illness, depression, because you kind of said at the beginning of the conversation here that, you know, a lot of times black people are a little more jaded because of the experiences they've been through. There's sort of this mm-hmm. tough veneer that, you know, mm-hmm. You guys put on sometimes with having to deal with this. And it's interesting to hear the other side of it with sort of the depression or mental illness, because I think there is this idea, and I don't really know why it exists, but I think there's this idea among white people that black people don't get depressed. You know,
Yeah, for some odd reason, because we don't bleed, right? We're not humans compared to everybody else. I think that this is a perfect example of like Kanye West, right? This man is literally going off at the mouth on Twitter, right? Talking about slavery was a choice, you know, all of these things.
Right.
And I personally think that Kanye West is sick. He is sick in his head. I think that he is crying out for help. And to a lot of people, this situation is funny, but to a lot of people of color, you know, this is very relatable. You know, we've all, like, most of us have had these points in our lives where we are literally seeking help and we are literally crying out for help. And there is nobody who looks like us, and there is nobody to validate those experiences. And even if there are people to validate those experiences, they're probably not close in range. They probably don't look like us. So, for example, right, whenever I was growing up, you know, I never was taught about self-care, and I never was taught about mental health. You just kind of get over it and get through it, right? And so now that I'm like a somewhat functioning adult, I try to take more care of my mental health, right? So I'm seeking out a psychologist, I'm seeking out counselors, I'm seeking out therapists. And like, just the act of trying to find a counselor or like even a Black therapist is very like tolling. It's very depressing. I remember I almost cried like a few months ago or like a few weeks back because I could not find a Black woman who does psychology or therapy here in Austin for adults. And that in itself is very, very frustrating. And, you know, I have literally been taught to research, right? I've been taught to seek people out. But just imagine people who don't have those skills.
Right.
And don't even know about those skills as well. Even in my own family, we don't even talk about mental health as much as we should be talking about. And I know a few people could be diagnosed with some things in my family. And it's very sad. But I think that we're getting a lot better. But especially in like these rural areas where we don't have those resources, you know, this is not a topic that's been coming up. And if it has, just not enough.
Well, yeah. And, you know, you're talking about this and saying you couldn't find a Black female therapist for adults in Austin. You know, we're talking about a very cosmopolitan, very liberal, very mixed city. And
but
you're
no,
still
and,
having.
And the thing is that a lot of people and that's one of the things I have against like white liberalism as well, is that Austin always talks about itself as this weird city, as this all inclusive city. But it's not. Like, I still go into stores here in Austin and I still get looked at sideways. Right. I live like literally down the street from a store and I still walk in and still get followed. But it's just a lot more low key than it would be in a lot of the more conservative regions of the state. And I think that white people who are good and are good intentioned also need to acknowledge that bias as well. Especially like, and even when I went to go to a white therapist to seek out like a Black counselor, a Black therapist, right? She couldn't even acknowledge, or she, you know, she couldn't even, like, it's your job to comfort me. It's your job to help me cope with things like that. And you couldn't even help me cope with this, right? With this idea that there are no people who look like me within the city, especially which is increasingly being gentrified, right? And I'm a transplant, right? I'm not born here in Austin. I'm not from Austin. And so I'm of a younger generation. And I have to actively seek out other people of color for just to hang out, right? Just to socialize with. And it's just like, it's very tiring.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And it's not easy to know how I myself have fallen into the sort of similar patterns of, you know, sort of like when you say like white liberalism, you think, oh, it's got to be fine, you know, or whatever, because because, you know, different looking people live here or something. And and you think that just makes it fine. But the idea of being lonely, maybe I'm a little more sensitive to this because I'm from, like I said, I'm from New Jersey. I'm from Trenton, New Jersey. And, you know, it's the capital and it's clogged. It's busy. It's not a great place to grow up. I got to tell you, it's not a lot of opportunities there. If you want to do something, you got to go somewhere else. So, but now I live out in the country in Northeast Texas, you know, and it's very rural around here and, you know, everything. And it's just the matter of even just like, I've noticed, I don't date, for example. And, you know, people have said to me like, well, why not? And the thing is, because the way that, you know, women here think who are from here is different than the way women I'm from think.
Yeah.
And it's very, very different. I mean, it's kind of like people back where I'm from will date and see where it goes. People here kind of want to get married. And that, I mean, I know that's a huge oversimplified generalization, but it's kind of a thing. And the point I'm making is that there are not people here like me. There are not, you know, people of a, you know, sort of, I don't know, sarcastic Northeast humor who have a certain perspective on life, you know, or, you know, like I'm a hockey fan, you know, things like that. Nobody is like me where I live. When I say I don't talk to anybody, I don't talk to anybody. I've been living in my house for 4 years and I don't know my neighbor's names. I don't know a single neighbor's name. You know, they don't talk to me. And because I don't, you know, I don't intermix with them really. I don't go to their churches. I don't, you know, I mean, I grew up in a Catholic background. There's no Catholics where I live, you know, things like that. So, I mean, so I can understand the isolation sense. And there are times when I did a whole other podcast on this very thing about country crazy, you know, where this idea of I sometimes am jittery about losing my mind out in the country because I'm the only one who is talking to me sometimes. Yeah. And, you know, I, you know, and when you talk to yourself a lot, you have an audience that already agrees with you. So it just, you become your own echo chamber. And so I've often worried about that, but I never really stopped to apply it to the experiences of other people like yourself. And it's, you know, it's very eye-opening to hear you say this without any real anger, but at the same time, you're obviously angry. I mean, you're about the situation. Yeah. I mean, you don't necessarily hate me, but you're, I hope not, but you're.
I think that being kind of introduced to this career field has taught me to use my anger productively. I recently did an interview with the author of this book called Eloquent Rage, and also read the book, which is a great read for a lot of Black women in the South who are trying to come into themselves. And it kind of talks about how, you know, at first this student had called her, she was just filled with so much rage, right? And she at first took offense to it, but then she was like, you know, I am enraged, I am upset, but she said at the same time, I can use that constructively and I can also teach people with that. And I can also acknowledge other people's experience with that as well, other Black women who are going through the same experience with me. And I feel like my pawpaw has always taught me never fight whenever you're in a rage, right? Like whenever you're in a fit, right? Or if you're too upset because you might end up hurting somebody. And I think that's what this fight about is about for me. It's like I try not to take all those feelings and try to like lay them out on the table all at once, right? I try to use feelings strategically, right? What am I doing in my community? What am I doing, you know, in my old community? Who am I talking to? You know, am I looking to one day be a mentor? You know, who's mentoring me? And so I think that when you look at it from that perspective, it can be very productive and very rewarding in the end, because then I have like Black women and then just people of color coming to me and being like, you know, wow, you are an inspiration, right? Or wow, I didn't know that I could do this and this, you know, or I could have this platform to say this. And for me, I think that's what my job is. My job is to show other people that even though you're raised a certain way, or even if you're raised in a certain area that tells you that you are limited, that limits you and doesn't give you the resources, you can still do whatever you want. You know, even if other people don't give you those tools, you can acquire those tools. And I hope that I'm sending out that message now, and I hope to do it even more in the future.
No, that's cool. I mean, it's very easy to fall victim to what bothers you in life, you know, and I've done it many times myself. And I'm one of those people who, unfortunately, a lot of times I will just not say anything about whatever is on my mind. Mm-hmm. And then like somebody drops a pencil and I'm like, son of a, and it just goes, you know, it's like this Tourette's level, you know, just like, you know, screaming match I go into. Everybody's like, whoa, why didn't you say something before? I'm like, I don't know. It didn't seem like a big deal, but that stuff, it does build up. So, I mean, I'm simultaneously glad that you have a platform from which to, you know, sort of use your elegant rage, as you said. That's a great title, by the way. I love that title. That's great. But I'm glad you have a platform to do that. But at the same time, you know, I'm upset for you that you have to, you know, if that makes sense. And I'm not trying to sound like, you know, this, you know, sort of piteous person or anything, you know, but I'm saying that it's a shame that it has to be that. But yeah, at the same time,
I feel like I try to tell a lot of white people, don't necessarily pity me, but do the work so that other people don't have to experience this. Right. You know, what are you doing in your community? Or what are you, what conversations are you having with your family and your friends as well? Because that's where you're going to make the biggest impact. Yeah. So, yeah.
Right. Well, that's,
thank you.
Yeah. Well, no, well, thank you. But it's, that's an interesting question to ask though, is, I mean, what could I actually do as opposed to talking to you? I mean, which I mean is obviously one good thing here, but like what can I do? I mean, like what, you know, as a white guy living among white people, what could I do? You know, I mean, and I'm genuinely asking, I mean, do you have suggestions?
I mean, I don't necessarily have suggestions because, you know, each experience is its own, but I do try to tell people to have these very constructive, these conversations, right? And don't have it with necessarily somebody you know is not going to listen to what you say, but you have to have both people kind of coming into the conversation, willing to both give and willing to both take. And yeah, I think that you can start it by that, correcting, you know, microaggressions, correcting, you know, things that you that people say that might be offensive to right. a certain culture, right? You know, if you see a black guy walking in the middle of the night, he might just be minding his business. Let your friend know, leave him alone. Don't call the police, right?
Right.
Because we've had that happen many occasions, and we were just chilling the whole time. So.
Right.
I think that it starts with little things like that. And then also just like educating yourself and be ready to equip yourself with the knowledge to defend these ideas and also be willing to take criticism from people of color, right? And from queer identifying folks, right? I'm a cis black woman, right? So I have some privilege over a lot of my queer friends. And there are times when my queer friends will correct me and let me know what's up. But at the same time, I'm taking that constructive criticism and I'm using it and I'm trying to teach other people as well moving forward.
You know, I think it's one of the hardest things that people do when they're trying to do the right thing is be able to take the backlash, you know, especially because, you know, on this, I mean, I can only go so far with my understanding because I don't experience it the way you do. And I never will. You know, it's not something I ever could fully experience. So I can only go so far when somebody, if they challenge me, there's a point at which my limit has to sort of stop and go, well, okay, I can't answer that. I don't know anything beyond what I know. But at the same time, I think a lot of people do have to sort of sack up, to be honest with you, and just be willing to take, you know, sort of the backlash. And maybe it's easy for me to say that as a person in journalism for a long time, because one of the things that I agree with my news director here, Mark Haslett, has told me, you know, that the price tag for having the platform when you speak is that you are going to get people who speak back, because as a reporter, you know this. I mean, you do a story and somebody hates it and you get an earful, you know, from
all of the time.
You know, it happens a lot. And just, you know, and there are days I walk in here and I walk out of here and I think, God, I love my job so much. And there are certain days I walk out like, I can't believe I did this to myself. This is awful, you know. But you have to, when you have the platform to speak, you have to be able to be spoken to in return.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing for people to do.
Yeah, I think that that's really hard too when you're not used to it, right? Like you said, you're a reporter, so you're used to getting this feedback. But I think that a lot of white people, of course, you know, what comes with privilege is you don't have to listen, or you don't have to experience these things, and you don't have to listen to us. Or there was one point where you didn't have to, and so now hear this is very new to you. And of course, everybody's going to be defensive, right?
Right.
But I mean, my thing is it's kind of like teaching a child, right? Whenever you teach like a toddler something, they always argue back. They like to push back, right? But in the end, they end up learning and they end up being better for it. So I think that this is what this is. It's kind of like learning on how to take that feedback, right? And learning how to be uncomfortable. Like, I think that a lot of white people don't realize that black people, literally when I wake up, when I walk out of my house, I am uncomfortable from the time I walk out and I walk back in at night, right? And learning how to cope with that uncomfortability and learning how to grow within that as well.
Yeah, I do think that's, like I said, that's the thing. Like, I don't feel uncomfortable. So that's why I'm saying I don't have that, you know, experience that you're talking about. But, you know, when you talk about the sort of the pushback, it does make me think of the Me Too movement, as I mentioned earlier, you know, where the difference? Because somebody said this to me, you know, like, what do you think is the difference? Like, you know, why is it now all this stuff is coming out, you know, when you get everything from Harvey Weinstein through, you know, now Tom Brokaw, you know, and it's just one sort of famous guy after another for, you know, a couple of months there. It was just one after another falling like trees. And it was like, oh, man, not him. I like that guy, you know, and it was just, you know, there. I think there was that reaction that we had. And I said, well, the difference is that guys are actually listening this time around, because it's not, this is not new. Women have been saying this for a long time. Yeah. It's the fact that guys are actually going, oh, really? Tell me more now. And so I think in that sense, there is hope for this conversation that you get exhausted having, because, you know, there is some precedent, I think, now that people are listening, you know, you know, I see it in the Me Too movement. I've seen it in the transgender community, you know, where like people are actually paying attention a little more, like, okay, what is it you're actually saying? So I think there is a chance for some hope here, but obviously there is quite a lot of work still ahead on this whole thing.
Yeah. And I don't even think that work is going to be done in my lifetime or my children's lifetime or their children's lifetime. But I do hope that just like what my grandparents went through, just like what my parents went through, that, you know, they don't have to experience a lot of the nastiness of the world up front, right? Mm-hmm. I have hope as well. I just think that we're very far away from getting all the way there, if we ever do, if there is even a possibility of getting all the way there.
Convo is a production of KETR FM in Commerce, Texas. Production and logo design by Scott Morgan. Music by Arik Deninja. Additional episodes of Convo are available at ketr.org. You can support this program and others like it by visiting ketr.org and clicking donate.